Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. The 29th annual Woods Hole Film Festival gets underway this Saturday, and while you can't see the films on the big screen with other theatergoers this year, you can enjoy the great lineup of films from the comfort of your home. Joining us is Judy Laster, Executive Director of the Woods Hole Film Festival. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mindy.
Many film festivals pulled the plug this year. What were some of the considerations you and your colleagues made about whether to cancel or run the film festival this year?
A lot of it had to do with the fact that we have so many great films, and we figured out a way, with the help of a lot of other people, to move everything we do into the virtual space. Mm-hmm. We are trying to have the Woods Hole Film Festival have the look and feel of the in-person event, but it will take place virtually, which means online.
So describe how people will access the films and what the options are for seeing one or multiple films.
So actually with the virtual film festival, the great thing is you can watch a film from anywhere. And there's several ways. You can either buy a pass, which would give you access to everything, basically in an on-demand capacity. Or during the week of the festival, you could just buy a single ticket to one film and just watch it right then and there. We do have a number of live events as well, all the filmmaker Q&As, workshops, panel discussions, and music are live. So we've also developed a suggested watch schedule for people so that if they want to watch a film and then participate in the Zoom Q&A, it will have the feeling more of being at a traditional film festival screening event.
So aside from screening of the films, you're still able to, use all the other elements of the film festival, like the Q&As and the panel discussions and whatnot.
We are. And
that's awesome.
The great thing is that it enables filmmakers and panelists to participate from around the world, which is really wonderful. I mean, of course, nothing replaces being together live and in person, but we're doing the best we can under difficult circumstances to still create that opportunity for people.
Yeah. And I think another opportunity here is you can binge watch. If you feel like, a weekend, you have some weather and you want to just watch 2-3 films in a row, you can go for it from the comfort of your own home.
You can. And not only that, but if you buy a pass, you can have your family watch the films with you, although it'd be great if you bought, a few passes so that you were continuing to support the festival. But you can also watch a film over a 48-hour time period as many times as you want.
Oh. Now, the festival has four categories, and later in the hour we'll discuss three of the films in the narrative documentary category. But to put you on spot here and ask you to mention some of the films in the other categories that you're most excited about.
Well, let's start with films that, so basically we have narrative, which are, dramatic and comedy features. And one of them that we're really excited about is, well, we have two of them by festival alumni, one by Mark Stolaroff, The Last Days of Capitalism, and another one by Jonathan Wysocki, which is called Dramarama. The first one is a more dramatic, serious film. The second one is a comedy. But we have 140 short films as well. So we have feature, narrative, and documentary. And then of the short films, we have so many great ones. But one in particular, we're really, which is a lot of fun and we're happy to be showing, it's called Island Queen, which, was also filmed on the Island Queen here in Falmouth. Rachel Dratch stars in that film on Saturday Night Live.
And one of the good things about the short films, you said 140 short films, is that there aren't a lot of opportunities outside of film festivals to see some of these films.
That's true, and it's going to become even more difficult as the whole way of theatrical film distribution changes. But the great thing is, with the virtual opportunities that are being created, it could be a golden age for shorts. Because what we do is we put together short film blocks. And so you might see 6 or 7 films in a shorts block. But we also have like a kids day event, which has 2 longer short films, which are perfect for kids. And so it means that hopefully the short films will really come into their own as a type of film that is accessible for people to watch.
I don't think people realize how much work goes into planning a film festival. And I'm just thinking how you must have been in panic mode when all the news came of the pandemic and that we weren't going to be able to meet in person. And I know you start working on these film festivals almost as one ends for the, you know, working on the next one. But I think one of the great things about the film festivals, as mentioned, not only with the short films, there are so many great films made outside of Hollywood that don't make it to most cinemas that looking at these selections, you really, there's so many films to choose from. And there was a lot of work, I imagine, that went into pulling this off.
It was actually amazing. You know, this is our 29th year. And so some things were sort of normal, but in a way, this is our first year because we had to completely reimagine and reinvent how we are thinking about and producing this event. That's why what we decided early on was we were going to try and keep the look and feel of the Woods Hole Film Festival so that people felt they were like they were kind of located here, especially, you know, on the Cape. We have a lot of people who come here for the summer who live elsewhere. So we had to do all this beginning in the middle of March, which is generally when we are putting to bed our program and generally when we're giving the green light and we're all set to go. So it was pretty much a 24-hour-a-day operation and still kind of is to make this happen. But we're very excited about what we've done. We're thrilled that we still have so many filmmakers who will be premiering their work here. That's important work. They're important filmmakers, but they want to do it because they love the Woods Hole Film Festival. They love our audiences. But I think the filmmakers also realize that for them, hopefully this is a way that they will be able to have a much wider reach than they would ordinarily have. But a lot of the reason that they are sticking by us, and we are actually going to be one of the larger film festivals happening during this time period, because many of the other film festivals that have gone virtual have had to scale back their programs for a variety of reasons. So we're really hopeful that what we're creating is a new way of presenting this information, and that even when we do go back to be able to present festivals in person, I think we're always going to keep a virtual element of the festival, because we do realize that many people can't or don't want to travel. And maybe that will be the case for some period of time. And so we want to broaden our audience, but also still serve the audience that lives locally.
The Woods Hole Film Festival begins this Saturday and runs through August 1st. We'll post links with more information on how to screen films and participate in other festival-related activities at our website, capeandislands.org. Judy Lester, Executive Director of the Woods Hole Film Festival, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Mindy. Look forward to seeing you at the festival.
We're discussing some of the films at this year's Woods Hole Film Festival. The North Atlantic right whale is one of the world's most endangered species. Just this month, the International Union for Conservation of Nature listed the right whale as critically endangered on the red list of threatened animal species. On the present population trajectory, extinction of the species is likely. Entangled is a new feature-length documentary about how climate change has accelerated a collision between right whales, the lobster fishery, and a federal agency mandated to protect both. The film premieres at this year's Woods Hole Film Festival. Joining us is Boston Globe reporter and filmmaker David Abel. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also on the line with us is Stormy Mayo, Senior Scientist and Director of the Right Whale Ecology Program at the Center for Coastal Studies. Hi, Stormy.
Hi, Mindy. Good to be on.
Yeah, David, you've made films about New England fisheries in the past, Lobster Wars and Sacred Cod, and you cover environmental issues for the Globe. At the core of most environmental stories are humans. In your films, humans are not bad or good, despite the fact that we are the ones causing the environmental destruction, or in the case of the right whale, the potential extinction of a species. Is it challenging to make a film that doesn't assign blame?
Good question. And I think it's not a question of assigning blame. It's a question of understanding the complexity and the nuances of the issues involved. I think in the story of the right whale, it's incredibly complicated. Stormy knows this better than anyone. And, yeah. You know, there are people who are trying to make an honest living, and they've been doing it for generations. And it so happens that this incredibly rare species is often entangled in their gear. And they have made sacrifices. Many lobstermen have made sacrifices over the years to try to change the way they fish to reduce the threat of entanglements. But the threat of entanglement exists, and it is the leading cause of death of right whales, and has been for some time. And even those whales that do not die as a result of entanglement are seriously injured, and often it impairs their ability to reproduce, and that has led to the species being on the brink of extinction. There are now believed to be fewer, as you noted, fewer than 400 right whales left. And from my point of view, as a journalist and a filmmaker trying to tell the story, it's to really illuminate the challenges that face public policymakers as they wrestle with the difficult decisions that are required to keep the species thriving, or keep the species from extinction while allowing the lobster fishery to thrive. And those are really, really difficult questions to answer, and challenges that at this point really haven't been met.
Stormy, both you and Scott Landry, who is head of this disentanglement team at the Center for Coastal Studies, have said if people could only see what happens to marine mammals and turtles when they get entangled, there would be more of a public outcry. Describe the wounds that you've seen on the whales when they've been hit by a ship or entangled in fishing gear.
Well, we see, of course, the unfortunate spread all the way from recently entangled whales that are wild and frightened, obviously, to apply a human term, and probably in pain, all the way across to those that are really in their last breaths. We've certainly seen all of those. And in between the two, the beginning of the entanglement all the way down to what unfortunately is often their death, there is a long period in some cases of animals suffering. And I think when we talk about people reacting and how strong that reaction is likely to be, and when you see it, in fact, in the film, you realize that these are creatures that are being tortured perhaps more than the horrifying torture that happens with a number of animals and even humans for perhaps months, and in a couple of cases, years on end. They're dragging gear and they have ropes around them cutting into them. So it's a compelling view, and one that this film, I think, does an excellent job of capturing.
Yeah. David, your film has incredible footage of the right whales. You have some really beautiful and close shots, but there are also some disturbing images, the wounds of the entanglement, the gore of the necropsy. How did you strike a balance between giving viewers a sense of what human-induced right whale morbidity looks like, but not too much so that people would turn away?
Yeah, that's a great question, and a challenge as a filmmaker to try to find a balance. Clearly, we came across some really horrific images that we did not include in this film, and yet we tried not to shy away from showing the reality. There's one moment that I will never forget while making this film, and that was observing a necropsy of the first right whale to die last year, a whale by the name of Wolverine that was taken to a beach in New Brunswick on the Acadian coast, and just to see this whale completely intact in the morning, and and on a beach just as dawn had broke, and then to watch it being taken apart and from the first cut to pretty much the last. And it is a gruesome sight and really sad. And at the same time, I feel like it's important for people to see what happens when these whales die, and to know that I believe all of the right whales that have died since 2010, correct me if I'm wrong, Stormy, have died as a result of human beings, all the whales that we've found.
It is that that humans' involvement in this story is profound. It even goes back deeper into the past when whalers brought the species, in that case, intentionally took the animals and brought them to very low numbers. And we're just dealing with the unfortunate burnt-out ends of the story. But it is a human story, and I think that's why this film has an important place, because it is clear that it's a conflict between the endangered right whale and, in some cases, endangered fisheries or individual fishing operations.
Mm-hmm. Stormy, as I mentioned, the right whale is now on the list of critically endangered species, and we've already had a right whale calf found dead this summer. Will this designation offer any further protections for the whales? You know, do you know of other species with this designation that have recovered enough to be removed from that list?
I personally don't, but let me say that this is like the issue has many different layers. The effort to save them, and I think the recognition by the IUCN of the critical state of the species, something we've in the field have known for some time, thanks to a number of scientists working on population trajectories, that has to help because it will further highlight the issue. And usually that brings out further support for the protection of the animals. But as David's film has shown, it is not there's not a simple solution. So more highlighting by the IUCN and by David's film is helpful, but it is a very difficult, almost intractable problem. And at the end of it, the right whales continue to decline.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, has a dual mandate, sustaining fisheries and protecting species. David, after making this film, do you think this puts NOAA in an impossible situation, or does this provide the agency with more power to make meaningful change?
Well, I hope our film puts some pressure on them through the disclosure of what's gone on and how this process has not reached a conclusion. When I say process, I mean this NOAA-led effort to try to reduce the number of lobster lines in the Gulf of Maine and require fishermen to use rope that breaks at less pressure and closures of certain areas and markings of gear, all of these things that federal officials, as well as scientists, as well as folks like Stormy, have been calling for years. Stormy sits on a group called the Atlantic Large Whale Take Reduction Team that is organized by NOAA. And more than a year ago, they came up with a historic agreement, which was, I think, unheard of in the history of this team to take some of the measures that I just listed, and it's up to NOAA to act on those, and they haven't. My concern at the moment is that politics could be influencing the policy as we approach the election. So there was these measures were supposed to be announced and implemented some 6 months ago at this point, and there has been delay after delay, and it looks like those delays could continue through the fall as the election nears, and that creates great uncertainty, especially at a time when we've seen the population decline so precipitously. In the last 3 years, we've seen 31 right whales die, and those are just the ones that are found. We know another 10 are severely injured and are believed to be near death. And as you noted earlier, we've seen we just lost a calf, and we thankfully had 10 calves born this calving season. But two of them, or 20% of the calves born this calving season, have died, and that's difficult for a species that needs on the order of about 30 calves a year to be a viable species to avoid extinction.
Stormy, you want to add anything to that?
Well, no, I think that's well said. But people must think about this as in many ways, with the analog of the COVID problem. Think of how complicated in our lives the COVID problem is, with the overlap of science and the effort to keep economic viability. The same thing is happening with the right whales. The conflict, and it is somewhat of a conflict, between the science, which we should all listen to, albeit it's still evolving, and the problem of trying to keep industries that depend on, for instance, in this case, fishing, keep that going. Families are in the lurch, and those are right whale families as well as human families. And it is an extraordinarily difficult problem, and one that at the end, in the case of right whales, but not in the case of humans in that COVID analog, but in the case of right whales, extinction is at the end of it, and it appears quite close. And I think that's the message of the IUCN.
David, despite the gravity of the situation, the film does include reasons for optimism. After making the film, what gives you hope for the future of the right whale?
Well, I would just say, and I think in the film, Stormy really, really touches on this. There is a possible future that we could see of lobstermen and the whales coexisting, and that is ropeless fishing. And the technology has advanced substantially in recent years, and there are all kinds of different types of ropeless gear that could be used. And the hope is that in the not-too-distant future, perhaps with some sort of federal subsidy, the fishing industry could be outfitted with technology that wouldn't require the vertical buoy lines that are the chief source of entanglement to right whales.
Stormy, you want to add anything?
Well, I'd like to stick my neck way out and go so far as to say that we have the solution to the entanglement problem, and it is before us. It's not easy like solutions to many of these issues, but it is ropeless fishing. And that will make better, if it's possible, for the industry, better an ecosystem, not just for right whales, but for all whales and for giant turtles and, in fact, for sharks and whatever that get entangled also.
Yeah. David Ibble's documentary is Entangled. I highly recommend it. It premieres at the Woods Hole Film Festival this month. David, thanks so much for joining us and for doing the film.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Stormy Mayo, director of the Right Whale Ecology Program at the Center for Coastal Studies, thank you as well. You know, I admire all the work that you guys do there, so really appreciate you being with us.
Well, thank you, and also thanks to David for putting that film together. It's an important contribution.
You're listening to The Point, and we are discussing films screening at this year's Woods Hole Film Festival. As events of the past few months have highlighted, we are a country divided, whether it's differences in political views, the reality of racial bias, religious affiliation, or even if it's necessary to wear a mask to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. Americans are not a country united. While we know it's a problem, how to fix it is less obvious. The Reunited States is a new documentary film telling the story of individuals working to understand and help bridge the divides amongst Americans. Filmmaker Ben Ricci joins us. Welcome.
Hi, nice to meet you. Thanks for having me.
Sure. When and how did the idea to make this film come to you? I mean, many Americans know this is a big problem, but it's so large and complex that it becomes daunting for most of us to even imagine tackling.
Yeah, well, I grew up, you know, in a mixed culture household. My dad was an Indian immigrant and my mom was East Coast American from Connecticut. And my dad was, you know, leaned right and was Republican, and my mom was Democrat. And so I think from an early age, it was, you know, bridging divides was something that was inherent in me, even though I might not have realized it. And it was really, you know, like many of us after 2016, after the election, was just trying to understand and navigate this new reality. And I was had the good fortune of seeing Susan Bro give a speech in D.C. And Susan Bro is the mother of Heather Heyer, who was killed in Charlottesville when the car drove through the crowd. And Susan, you know, had suffered this unimaginable tragedy and was speaking about the need to have difficult conversations, to understand each other better, to prevent further violence from happening. And it kind of hit me like a ton of bricks. Like, here's someone who, you know, has gone through, is on the front lines of division and is talking about the need for, you know, conversation. What are the rest of us doing? Like, how petty am I for being hung up on, you know, these political disagreements? And so I went up to her afterwards and I said, I don't know how or why, but I want to help tell your story because you're a voice of reason in a time where there's a vacuum of them. Mm. And she kind of eyed me and gave me her number and was very skeptical at first, but I kind of just poured my heart out to her and said, you know, people need to hear your story and understand. And that was the beginning of the journey.
Yeah. The film weaves the stories of three individuals and one family, as you mentioned, committed to helping bridge the divides in America is Susan Brown. We have a clip of that. Let's take a listen.
She was still alive a year ago right now. She was hot. She was tired. She was thirsty. She was still alive.
My daughter was not a leader. She was not a known activist. He just drove into a crowd, and she was the one who happened to die.
Thank you for coming to remember Heather, but this was not all about Heather. We have a huge problem in our city and in our country. We have got to fix this or we'll be right back here in no time. The world went crazy when Heather lost her life, and that's not fair because so many mothers lose their children every day, and we have to fix that. I don't want other mothers to be in my spot. I don't want other mothers to go through this. So today, not only do we remember my baby girl, I want to thank the troopers for their sacrifice who lost their lives that day. There's so much healing to do, and we've got to do it together. Amen.
I hear that clip, and I'm reminded of the parents of the slain children in Sandy Hook, Connecticut, imploring Americans to make changes to gun laws, and it seemed to fall on deaf ears. Is Susan's message resonating with people?
I think it is. I mean, of course, you know, people have their deeply held beliefs one way or the other, and I think what makes Susan's story unique is that she very clearly identifies the fact that her daughter was white as the reason she got so much attention, and that if it had been a person of color, it might not have got the same attention. And she's very quick to move the attention to where it deserves to be, which is on the issues that her daughter died for. Yeah. And so I that really struck me, and that was part of, you know, her agreeing to be in the film, was she kind of told me, look, this isn't about me and my grief. Like, part of the problem is every time, you know, there's an interview with me, I say all this stuff about the racial injustice, but then they just use the clip where I'm crying about my daughter. And if we do this, I really want to highlight the stories and voices that this is, this longer term journey is about. And I said, that's it. That's the story. And so she's really has this self-awareness and this ability to distill these high level wisdoms into these easy to understand sound bites. And I think in a time where we're shouting past each other, that's why she's had staying power.
Yeah. Now tell us about the Levertin family.
The Levertins were extraordinary. I was introduced to them, and basically David Levertin used to work in Republican politics. He worked for a senator, and his role was, you know, to win campaigns and to fuel, foment division and fear of the other side. And in 2016, you know, when the violence started happening around the election, he realized that the divisions he'd been fueling were now on full display. And so his wife kind of turned to him and said, look, if you didn't have a job and a mortgage and kids, what would you want to do with your life? And without thinking, he said, I'd want to help bring unity to America. I'd want to undo some of the harm that I feel that I've done. And she, you know, they kind of looked at each other and said, well, let's figure that out. What does that look like? And they ultimately decided to sell their house, buy an RV, and to travel to all 50 states with their three kids to understand what was dividing us. And they go into Black communities and Native reservations and border towns and really have these true moments of understanding that, you know, being an American for one person is not the same as being an American for someone else. And it was just really powerful to see these moments where they would actually, like, you know, listen to these stories and take it in and say, wait a second, I have these blind spots of prejudice and that we all do, whether we're on the left or the right, that we need to reconcile if we're to move forward as a country together.
Yeah. And we have a clip from the film of David and Aaron Levertin. Let's take a listen.
And so I think what we've found in this country, we've never been forced to deal with the things that have caused to where we are today. And so to heal them, we have to go pretty far back.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever meet anybody that didn't want to talk to you?
So we're in Savannah, Georgia, kind of early on our trip. And I'm reaching out to this guy who's a real kind of community leader in Savannah.
African-American gentleman.
African-American guy. He's 85 years old. He's lived in Georgia his whole life. Mm-hmm. So he's seen lots in his days in Georgia. And he goes, David, you know, even if I had time to meet with you, I don't think I would.
Oh, okay.
So I was like, okay, all right.
Did he give a reason?
He goes, it's hard to be reconciled with someone who has a boot on your neck.
Wow.
That is not the America that I believe that I live in. He saw me as a white guy outsider walking up to him standing over here where he's got a boot on his neck, and for me to come up to him and say, hey, can we all just get along? But before we do that, we've got to deal with the boot. Mm-hmm. And I had to realize that he associated me with the man standing on top of him.
Given the conversations we're having around institutionalized racism and white privilege, the image of the boot on the neck will probably resonate with white viewers. What do you hope that viewers will take away from that moment in the film?
You know, this is one of those moments where, you know, we shot this film over the past 2 years, and then, you know, we never could have imagined the world that it would come into and the relevance that it would have now. I think especially in light of George Floyd, the boot on the neck reference is extremely powerful. I get chills when I hear it now. And, you know, what my hope is that this film shows the transformation that we all have to go through to a certain degree, which is starting in one place about our understanding of race and each other and justice. And through experience, not just conversation alone, through interaction, can we transform? And I find that transformation incredibly dramatic. And ultimately, you know, the thoughts, words, and actions that we all feel towards our fellow Americans really matter. And, you know, whether we're on the left or the right, you know, whether we think we're fighting for on the right side of an issue or the right side of history, the dehumanization and prejudice that we're placing on each other, on tens of millions of Americans, is the problem. And so, this isn't a film about fixing government. This isn't about, you know, democracy reform as much as it is fixing us and saying, wait a minute, maybe when I post that tweet or that Facebook message, you know, where I think I'm fighting on the right side of justice, but maybe calling, you know, everyone who voted for Trump a racist is actually a form of prejudice as well. And so it's really, the hope is like to have a bit of self-reflection and stop pointing at other people and start looking within.
The film also highlights those who are working for change on an institutional level. Tell us a little bit more about the Millennial Action Project.
Yeah, the Millennial Action Project was founded by Stephen Olakara, Indian American gentleman in Wisconsin, a very deeply purple and divided state. And his, you know, realization when he was 23 was that the gridlock in government is not allowing any change to happen. And, you know, as a young person, Bobby Kennedy said, you have the least ties to the past and the greatest stake in the future, but they're highly underrepresented in government. The average age of someone in Congress is 20 years above the average age of the average American. And so his idea was to start a coalition of millennial lawmakers. Basically, if you're under 40 and you have a willingness to work across the political divide, you could join this Future Caucus. And, you know, the idea being that young people aren't as hung up on labels of red and blue, that they feel much more independent minded and, you know, realize they've been given a broken system. And so he has, you know, the top 40 members in the federal Congress, along with in state offices across the country. And so now he's built this coalition of 800 lawmakers that are committed to working across the divide at the state Senate, state Congress, and federal Congress level. And the kind of impact they're having, like coming up with really out-of-the-box solutions, like you mentioned gun reform earlier, through the Millennial Action Project, they came up with a policy that actually passed into law that removed a ban from the CDC investigating gun violence as a public health crisis. And that's something that happened from young people. And so it really gives me hope because, you know, I've met now congressmen and state senators that are 22, 25, Black, Asian, Hispanic, that are committed to working with Republicans and Democrats alike. And when they come of age and continue to rise in the ranks, we might see a paradigm shift in the way our government functions.
The film is The Reunited States and will be screened as part of the Woods Hole Film Festival. Since the festival is virtual this year, you can see any or all of the films, even if you're not in Woods Hole. Ben Ricky, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Mindy.
You're listening to The Point. We're discussing some of the films at this year's Woods Hole Film Festival. Our final film is a documentary about a vineyard fisherman named Richie Medeiros lost at sea in the early 1990s. The film is Somewhere with No Bridges, and joining us is filmmaker Charles Frank. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Charles, let's start with a clip from the film.
I never had the chance to know Richie. It's now been 20 years since he went missing. But I believe that on this island, you can still find him.
I don't know if you've seen the pictures of him. He was ripped. I mean, he didn't really lift weights. His natural build was like, you know, he's freaking strong.
Incredibly strong. Weirdly strong. Like, pick up a VW kind of
strong. He wasn't a big man, but he was a big man. And it was like, he had such a huge personality.
He was a dynamo. He really was. He was a freaking dynamo.
Every time we laughed, I just remember his mouth opening up really wide.
And he always sort of moved when he spoke. He was just full of energy.
Out the road, waving everybody. I can see him now. Eddie!
You know, and everything would kind of stop.
Full gas, full brake.
Constantly going.
Just moving fast. That was Richie.
He wasn't afraid of much.
You know, he'd take the world on.
What is your relationship to Richie, and why did the story of his life resonate with you?
Yeah, so Richie is actually a somewhat distant cousin of mine. But my father and him were raised together kind of as brothers on the island. And so I've been hearing stories about Richie from my dad and from other extended family my whole life. He's kind of this near mythic figure to me. And so, you know, we weren't originally going to make the film necessarily about Richie, but spending enough time on the island with friends and relatives, that
he kind of emerged as the main focus.
Yeah, so now trying to capture the nature and spirit of someone who is no longer with us can be almost impossible, but you managed to give viewers a real sense of Richie, partially by through the voices of the people who loved him. And what struck me about this clip that we just heard is the joy in people's voices as they remembered Richie. If you could sum him up in just a few words, how would you describe him?
You know, certainly larger than life, gregarious, but he's so hard to put in words. I never even was able to tell a full, complete story of him in the film because there were so many words to describe him, and that became a really tricky thing with the film is trying to define him in some simple way. But he seemed to mean something different to every person that loved him and connected with him. And that is actually part of what is so powerful to me about the force of him even still today.
Yeah. The film also conveys how place becomes part of a person and in turn how people leave their imprint on place. Do you think The Vineyard is unique in this way? And if so, how?
Yes, I certainly do. You know, I think there's a quality on the island that anybody who spent a significant amount of time there can feel. There's a spiritual type of kind of magical energy. And you know, in the beginning, we had thought that the film would be more of a traditional look at the stories of Richie and people's memory of him. But the more time we spent on the island, the more we started to feel kind of his spirit in the ocean, in the wind, in the trees, and in the cycles of the seasons. And that's something that's just so, on the island, I don't know exactly what it is, but you start feeling, you start feeling these kind of spiritual things there. Wow. And so Richie kind of is still on the island in one way or another.
In one way, yeah. And as you're saying, for the most part of the film, it does focus on the spirit of Richie, the attributes of character, the way he connects those living to the past, their younger selves, and to the island. Yet you also include what looks like some home video of Richie. Did you grapple with whether or not to include the images of Richie, or was it never a question in your mind that footage of him should be in the film?
That was a really tough thing to grapple with. There was a moment early on when we were editing the film where we distinctly showed Richie right in the beginning of the film, and for some reason it sort of took away some of the intangible qualities, the feelings and the memories, because it felt so too finite almost. And so we worked really hard at slowly trying to kind of slowly uncover who he was to everybody, and then also showing glimpses of him in the flesh, which, you know, we felt like was a necessary thing to do for viewers that didn't know Richie, don't have an image of him in their head. But we wanted to try to find a harmony and a balance.
How did your thinking about Richie, his life, or how he was being remembered change over the course of making the film? You know, you'd heard all these stories about him all your life. So how did that impact you?
I think I got closer to him by getting close to everyone he touched. I think that was the most powerful connection that I had, probably with anyone, because I felt like he had this power to draw me to all these people that I hadn't spent a lot of time with, even family members of mine that I had, you know, neglected to get really close with. He pulled me to them. And so in that way, I think I got closer to him as well.
Yeah. So what do you hope viewers, especially those who might not have a connection to The Vineyard, what do you hope they take away from the film?
My hope is actually something similar to what I was just describing. I think it's a film a lot about connecting with people that you love and thinking about your legacy and the mark you leave on the world. And so I'm hoping that it's a film that makes audiences want to reach out to someone they might feel distant from, or and try to build a bridge in a sense with them.
Yeah. Charles Frank is the director of the documentary feature Somewhere with No Bridges. It will be screened as part of this year's Woods Hole Film Festival, which is all virtual this year. Charles, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
We'll post links with more information about all the films we discussed this hour and how you can screen the films in this year's Woods Hole Film Festival at our website, capeandislands.org. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Burdery and William Coulter.